Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host, our loyal co-host. Good to see you, Daniel.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
I'm doing very well. Good. And we'd like to talk about something in foreign policy. And we've done that before.
A couple times.
There's been a subject that has generally been popular with our audience. They're very interested because it's very important. And that has to do with our relationship with China. Mm-hmm. And lots of things are going on right now. And, you know, we have the militarism that goes on between the two countries and with Russia and Iran. But we also have the trade problems going on. And it's a mixed bag. It isn't just United States problems with China, because right now, our administration has put a lot of sanctions, and they're getting ready to put a lot more back on Iran.
Yeah.
And anybody who violates them then are going to be punished. And it's a mixed bag now, because China does a lot of business with Iran. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the nuclear ban treaty was on with European nations and the United States against Iran, that was going well. But now we walked out of that, mm-hmm. and it's a messy situation. But we're saying, our government is saying, November 5th might be an important date for all we know, that the sanctions are going back on, and they're already, we've already have people in our administration that are punishing people who deal with the Iranians, you know, if they trade with them or do anything. And China is getting a little bit annoyed. I think they would like to opt out of the SWIFT payment program, but so far there's no easy exchange there. And I think the Europeans are sort of mixed on what to do, because some are saying, hey, we need business. We want to do this. We want to keep it. Opening up the door to Iran was a good idea. Yet it's sometimes, because we have threatened the sanction, some of the big companies are watching the bottom line, and that's all it means. So they're going to, and they've actually left Iran. So there's a lot to be resolved. But this week, I think the article that caught my attention in particular was that China cancels the annual U.S. security talks. You know, it's good when they're talking.
Yeah.
And we praise that and want that to happen and back away from the military confrontation. But they up and canceled it, and it has to do with our policies, and they're trying to act like a sovereign nation, and I think they're capable of doing so.
Yeah, you know, the Secretary Mattis was scheduled. There's a sort of a yearly meeting that he has with his counterpart, the Defense Minister of China, and he was scheduled to, they were planning on him going out in October to do this annual talk. It was the Diplomatic and Security Dialogue Talks. But the Chinese Defense Minister said, I don't want to meet with him. I'm not going to meet with you. So that kind of put the meeting on a kind of a rock. It would have been, I guess, a tourist trip if he had gone. So there was no purpose to go. And it's strange how the U.S. acts as if, the U.S. government acts as if this is kind of a surprise. Like, what are they so mad about? What's the problem? You know, when we have a list, we'll go through, as we go through the show, a list of things that indicate that the relationship is deteriorating, not only on an economic level, not only on a trade level, but really coming down to it, as you always say, trade wars often become hot wars, and we're seeing some of that kind of percolating.
Right, and, you know, just recently there was this naval incident where there was a Chinese intercept of an American vessel in the South China Sea over these islands that have been dredged up. They're small islands, and we think this is the litmus test for the sovereignty and the safety of the United States, that we declare that, oh, they're on international waters, and we're going to test it, and we're going to send our destroyers right up to the brink of this. And, you know, there's probably a technicality there they're dealing with, but I think it's overkill for us to send destroyers over there. Why don't they just stay in the trade lanes, go up and down the South, you know, China South Sea, which carries a lot of cargo, and that China has no reason to try to discourage people from using it. It's this kind of stuff that would discourage people from using these sea lanes. But anyway, that's happening, and that was another thing that destroyer up against destroyer, and they got pretty close together, and they said, well, we were 45 yards apart, so no big problem. Yeah. But I would think that involves some risk in a procedure like that.
Yeah, and these are the freedom of navigation operations that the U.S. Navy conducts in the South China Sea, the word China being, I think, probably important. But the USS Decatur was within 12 miles of two islands that China claims in the South China Sea. And so a Chinese destroyer came up, as you point out, pretty close to them and warned them off. And that irritated the U.S. But also late last week, Dr. Paul, the U.S. Released some photos of the USS Wasp conducting live fire exercises in the South China Sea as well. So clearly the U.S. is demonstrating that it intends to continue its military presence and challenging China in the South China Sea.
Yeah, and we've had an arrangement with Hong Kong where our ships, even our military ships, could stop in and maybe refuel or whatever. But this past week, they were denied in retaliation against the sanction against a Chinese company for buying something from Russia, military stuff. But how did it happen all of a sudden that China has to get permission from us if they're going to buy something from Russia? But that's what it's coming to, especially, you know, after November 5th. With these new sanctions, there's going to be a lot more challenges on this. And what we will have to do to enforce this is something else. If we don't enforce it, then, oh, we're losing credibility and it's not going to work. So this is something that is stirring. There's been these several incidences now, and there's an atmosphere now that there's a claim by some of the so-called experts that, you know, with the outcome of the new NAFTA agreement, that Trump now can turn to China and work out all this trade. I'll tell you what. Arrangement with China is a lot bigger deal than you know with Canada and Mexico, and even that has yet to be fully understood. It probably was minimal compared to what has to be dealt with China, and even the new NAFTA thing didn't get rid of the aluminum and steel sanctions, you know, the tariffs that we put on. So that whole agreement has to be reassessed too. But the claim is Trump had a major victory here, and he's gung-ho, he's ready to go, and he's in a tough negotiating mood, and that's now it's going to China and settle our trade problems with China.
And you know, this whole sanctions of China over the purchase of Russian military equipment, I think this is something very significant, because the reasons China was punished for this is because we have all these sanctions on Russia. And so it's not only sanctions on Russia forbidding Russia from doing this, but it punishes any country that does business with Russia. So these are kind of second degree sanctions. The Chinese went and bought some military equipment from the Russians, and the U.S. slapped sanctions on it, forbids any financial or any transactions that go through the U.S. banks. That's how they do it. And because of the U.S., the dollar is key, most of these transactions do. So in a way, these kinds of sanctions encourage these kinds of go-arounds that more and more we're seeing.
And, you know, the European Union is not as unified as it has been in the past, and there are some people who would be much more willing to challenge these sanctions, and others who have to protect the bottom line will get out, out of Iran. But I think this is going to lead to a confrontation with some European countries. Who knows where Germany's going, which way they're going to do. They have to deal with buying, and we mentioned that yesterday, talking about buying cheaper oil from Russia, which we say, no way, you're going to buy it and pay more by American.
Well, that's you made a good point earlier on that really should be underscored, is the break between the political side and the business side in Europe. And I think that's significant. You rightly point out that the political side really wants the Iran deal to work, because they want to point to the U.S. that, look, we negotiated this in good faith. We spent years putting it together. You walked out of it unilaterally, and that's a bad and a dumb thing to do. But on the other hand, as you also say, the business, the big business, especially the big corporations, we do this much business with Iran and this much with the U.S., and they're feeling skittish.
You know, and this has a lot to do with oil. There's no doubt about pipelines and all. And we mentioned the other day about the significance of oil in Venezuela, you know, where most of the biggest oil reserve is. So the oil prices, I watch those carefully, and they're up to $75. Haven't been up there for maybe 4 years or so. And they were, you know, once fracking came in, there was a huge supply, and everybody was pumping. But now, all of a sudden, there's these concerns. And I think it's a mixed bag. I think it's economic. I think it's military, what's going on here. Because, you know, they're still pumping, and but there's the future. They don't know. Iran can still export some, but we want to stop them totally and completely. But at the same time, our policy from the administration is we want the price of oil to stay low. You know, well, you can't have it that way. But I think about what it was like in the 1970s. Oil was under $4 a barrel, three something, wow, in the early part of the 70s. And the Saudis had most, they were controlling the oil prices and all. But then there was a fight, and it involved Israel, and the Arabs had to boycott. And our prices started to soar. They went up to, by the 1980s, it was up like $30 or so. Huge increase. And I often thought, well, yes, there's a boycott. Everybody said it was a boycott. 100% the boycott. But they never factor in. They never want to call attention to the monetary inflation, which is an adjustment there. There is inflation. Today, people say, no inflation. Prices aren't going up. So I think we have this threat of a shortage in the supply line and this turmoil over here. But also, people say, well, where's all this money going? It's not pushing prices up. Well, maybe this money is starting to shift a little bit and go into the oil market and cause a little more speculation on prices going up. So it is. There has not yet been an absolute shortage, and it may be. And so I think if oil goes, which I would expect is not a huge prediction, I would think oil is going over $100 in not too distant future, maybe within a year or so, and it will have to do with this geopolitical stuff. But it also has to do with the value of the dollar, and it's shifting. For a long time, people keep saying there's no inflation, but how about inflation in the stock market, inflation in the bond market, and inflation on the living expenses for the people who are retired? So I think, in a way, it's an excuse for prices to go up, but the real reason prices will go up and stay will probably have to do with the monetary factor, and that you have old-fashioned inflation. But they'll never talk. They never talk about, well, this is inflation. This is caused by us having too much debt and printing too much money and all this. No, that's too far removed. This is all due to just the Iranians, because they're causing all the trouble.
Well, what do you think about some kind of a perfect storm arising then, where you've got increasing prices on products because of the higher tariffs? I think, was it a 10% tariffs on 200 billion more Chinese goods, plus oil going up? How is Trump going to take credit for the economy if these two things happen simultaneously?
With difficulty. No, I think that, you know, it's you know, there's some benefits to saying, you know, what's happening. It's better than having the whole market have crashed under Trump. But no, I mean, people are working and things are happening. But also, guess what the report was yesterday? You know, this end of the fiscal year, $1.2 trillion deficit this year. So it's jumping up faster. And I think it's going to be over $1 trillion pretty consistently, because if they cut off the spending, then that's going to accelerate the recession that's destined to come anyway. So they're not going to cut off the spending. And I think if push comes to shove, that the Fed will back off. They will not continue to tighten and push interest rates up. For some reason, I just don't think they'll be capable of doing that. But so far, they've been able to do it, and the market's doing well. But no, I think the trade problems, in combination with the inflation that's coming, in combination with who knows what's going to happen with the militarism, you know, that exists, it's unstable. And the economic instability comes from the fact that interest rates have been so drastically below normal, below zero, mm-hmm. And that establishes these conditions that are very fragile. But as of now, I think the president deserves a lot of credit for, in spite of all the negative things said, he gets credit for being a market cheerleader. Mm-hmm. And there is a subjective factor to markets. You know, if people feel good and feel good, you know, and that is borrow mm-hmm. more money, and the party is on. But eventually the party ends, and how it ends with the trade wars, with the basic inflation and the militarism that's going on, it remains to be seen. I think it'd be risky if anybody could say, well, I know what it's going to be like in 6 months or whatever. But long term, this can't continue. And things that can't continue usually don't. Yeah. And it's just a matter of timing, trying to get people prepared so that if we do really have some bad, bad economic times and trade problems, there has to be an explanation on what we ought to be doing. And that's why I think the founders were astoundingly great, is that they came up with a package. It is said that the revolution was the only war that ever was carried out where the people had more freedom rather than less. It's just saying, and you've made the point about all these coups around the world. Every time that happens, the people end up worse off, less free. We get rid of one dictator, usher in another one. So what we have to do is think about how do we present the case for, you know, freedom, civil liberties, individual rights, peace, free trade, you know, and get rid of this militaristic attitude and convince people that is the better way to go rather than march in lockstep behind Bernie Sanders.
Well, a couple more things that closing out on our concerns and our view that this is getting more militarized. You had, remember, in the UN speech where President Trump blamed Beijing for meddling in the U.S. elections, and everyone sort of said, what are you talking about, you know? And they pressed him on it, and he, I don't know if you saw this, he tweeted a supplement paid for by the Chinese government in a newspaper in Iowa. And, you know, this is common practice for years and years. Foreign countries will insert a supplement into the Washington Post, you know, come visit China, come visit wherever, and do business and have a holiday and this sort of thing. He pointed to this as evidence that trying to meddle in the election. So it shows more than a little naivete. And the other thing would just be the U.S. recent overtures to Taiwan, and that's obviously got China pretty irritated, selling $330 million of spare parts for F-16s and other military things. So this sort of rounds out our claim that this little trade war, there are some military components to it.
You know, and I'll finish up by just emphasizing this sort of a dream that I have on what we should replace this mess with. And it has to do with presenting a policy that people can understand and put together and feel good about it. But that is something that is available to us, but we just have to basically understand what individual rights are all about. Under those conditions, that things would improve if we could just get people to understand this. But I think we're moving, obviously, in the wrong direction right now, but the mess that's coming will be an opportunity for people to think about what are the options, and that, of course, is where I think we're making progress. We're not making progress in Washington. If you look at what's happened in Washington over the last 2 or 3 weeks, you say, there's no hope at all. But that's not where the world changes. The world changes outside of Washington. And, I mean, the final cleansing and the draining of a swamp doesn't occur, with a few strokes of the pen. It occurs when the people's attitudes change, when they have, once again, confidence in liberty and believing that they can take care of themselves and that we don't need, a government that's going to take care of us and that we need somebody policing the world. And one thing I would suggest that we do in order to move this along is to state a basic principle and follow through that we will no longer interfere in the internal affairs of other nations in other people's elections and not pick and choose and support dictators around the world, not support any coups anymore, and mind our own business. Believe me, hopefully that would set a standard that would others might follow. But I think that we have a bit of responsibility of changing that policy, because there's nobody else in this world right now, and maybe throughout history, who ever was involved in so many internal activities in the governments of other nations and participating. And we could start there with reining in and eventually getting rid of the CIA. It serves no purpose for a free society. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.